novamente. Thank you very much. I think we can start now. Before we start, can we observe the silence for prayer? Thank you very much. Honourable members, the agenda, I think, is in front of you. The meeting is officially open. And you're all welcome to this meeting. Feel free, ask questions, and clarity is free. Any apologies, questions before we go?
Yes, Sheikh, as well, I want to fully apologize, not really well.
Honorable Manipule, and aware that Honorable Shanga is still out of the country. Before we go forward, can we adopt the agenda in front of you as it is, or any amendments that the members can add? Thank you. Can I adopt the agenda? Any proposal? Yes, Honorable Mahathis. Kona? Thank you, Honorable Provision. Members, we are expecting the briefing by the Department of Justice on the criminal matter, which is Section 75. And also number three is a briefing by the same department on the Judicial Matter Amendment Bill, also Section 75. I'd like to take this opportunity to, I think the matter has always been asked, but let's introduce ourselves. My name is Dumisan Kingi, I'm delegate from Western Cape, chairperson of the Security and Justice. Can we go with Honorable Wana?
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Tabiso Wana, permanent delegate from the Eastern Cape.
Good morning. My name is Setlamara Wazileja. I'm a permanent delegate from the Mpopo, a member of this committee.
So thank you. My name is Jihad Mohapi, Free State.
Good morning, my name is George Mislakis, I'm a delegate from the Free State.
Good morning, my name is Madam Chen, I'm a delegate from KZN.
Thank you very much. You can introduce yourself from Pepe.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Louis Mann, the permanent delegate from KZN, member of this committee.
Honorable Zimanda is also a whip of this committee. At the PETE, Honorable Hoshi Tobiran is the chairperson of petitions. Next to him, Honorable Mahadi is the chairperson of COPSA. Can you introduce yourself, myself, before proceeding?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lawrence Bassett from the Department of Justice in the Legislation Section.
Thank you very much. As official administrative secretary and conduct advisor, there is our researcher. There is one of the officials. Thank you very much. Let me hand it over to you.
Thank you, Chair. We've got the two briefings, as you said. I'll be doing the briefing on the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill, and Dr. Gwede will be doing the briefing on the Criminal Matters Amendment Bill. Chair, we would like the guidance what you would like to do first. We have submitted a PowerPoint presentation on both the bills, and we would appreciate guidance on how much detail you want us to go into. Do you want to really have summary of what's in the briefing document? We accept that honourable members have read it, and we would just like your guidance on which we should do first, and how detailed would you like the briefing? Thank you.
programs there, but you can not read it as it. You can just, you know, your presentation. You cannot even go to one page to page, but you can summarize it in a way that the member can understand.
Thank you, Chairperson. Would you permission, before I start talking to the bill, I really would like you to focus on the steps that's incorporated into the slide to give you some indication as to the nature and the scope of the problem that we would like to address through the bill. You would see the stats they get by SACIT, South African Commerce of Trade and Industry, and that's what they call the proper theft barometer. And the stats are only relevant insofar as theft of copper from Eskom, Telkom, and Transnet is concerned. You can see there that if you look at the cost of replacing stolen metal, you could see the increase there, 7.8% increase. That is April this year vis-a-vis April last year. What also is alarming, Chairperson, if you look at the volumes of copper stolen, if you look at April this year, you see it's 179 metric tons, and you see the increase there if you look at the figures for April 2014, which was 176 metric tons. Chair, I can just mention that the government is looking at different ways on operational level also to fight this. And despite many of these initiatives, we still have these high levels of copper theft. Then also, if we can go forward and see, if you look at the international average monthly copper spot price, you see that the increase there April 2015 vis-a-vis May 2014. And why I'm showing this to you is because unfortunately the higher the price, so the level of crime increases, so it's more profits for the criminal. Also then, if you look at the AI exports of waste copper products, look there, March 2015, it was 7.2 million as opposed to August last year, which was 7.0 million as well. So the increase is important to note. What is also alarming is that according to the copper theft barometer, South Africa has only 2% of the global reserve. But we are the largest exporter of copper to China and India. Also, what's important to know, look at the loss to the economy, 5 to 7 billion rand a year. And then also what's important, that is the, if you need to first replace the stolen metal before you can start with maintenance. So you can imagine what the impact of this will be on the economy and also our efforts to create jobs and also to eradicate poverty. Now, the state chairperson then showed a tendency of the level of crime which is unacceptably high. What is also important to realize, the stats only deal with copper, but it's not only copper that is stolen. There are also still various metals such as iron and steel. We heard from Transnet how many pages of railway lines have been stolen, and we must think about that effect as well. So for us, in the bill, we talk about essential infrastructure, and that share for us is the infrastructure that which is used to provide or distribute the means. I call it the means here just by way of explanation. And the means is here, all the broad public, we all need electricity, we need water, and we need transportation. And if I say the infrastructure provides the means, and I say it to the broad public, it includes hospitals, it includes schools, it includes businesses. And all of us need these means in order to operate on a daily basis. What is also also important, if you look at the harmful consequences of these offences, it really poses a risk also to public safety. It has this negative impact on South Africa's economy, the society, and our infrastructure as well. What is complicating addressing these problems is that these offences are increasingly becoming more organised, and they are often committed by armed and dangerous criminal groups. A good example is what we saw in KZN there, how really lives were taken because of the criminal activities relating to the theft of the cable chain. We have to protect our infrastructure. There's a lot of public investment placed in that, and we want to see growth in South Africa to increase employment. And also we want to build safe communities, and therefore we need to address the threat. And the bill then provides for stricter provisions for the granting of funds and the sentencing of offenders who steal or damage or tackle with essential infrastructure. And in any cases, the theft thereof or the damage thereto result in an interference with the functioning of these services. So the aim of the bill in essence is to change the law. We want to change the law in relation to the granting of bail, and I just say at this point in time, the granting of bail in two ways. First, you must make this person's bail, and second, who is the owner to when you apply for bail. And then the other thing is the bill looks at or changes the law insofar as the imposition of minimum sentences concerned. And then the bill also creates a new offence relating to damaging, tampering or destruction of essential infrastructure. And that new offence, because of a consequential amendment, that offence will also be included in the Prevention of Organized Crime Act. So, and the laws we changed is the Criminal Procedure Act, that's the Act regulating bail. The Act regulating criminal or minimum sentences is the Criminal Law Amendment Act. And then, like I said, we're going to change the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, but in a very small way. And then the other thing is we're creating a new offense for the damaging and tampering with essential infrastructure, which is defined in the bill. You will see that there are three definitions. The definition basically serves to determine the scope of what the burglary was. The scope insofar as what does basic services mean, you can look at that. And the other thing is, what do we mean by essential infrastructure? Essential infrastructure, as I explained to you, it has to deal with the infrastructure that really provides us with the means to all of us to be able to do our daily and to perform our daily function. And then also we included the definition of tamper just to clarify the meaning and to say how does tamper differ from a damaging or a property. Then if you look at clause 2, that's where the amendments regarding bail come in. First, we're going to amend section 59 and 59A of the CPA. And let me call there and just say it's operators, it's prosecutors, certain police officials, and the court. Only these three functionaries can grant bail. So what we want to do is we want to amend sections 59 and 59A so that no longer police officials or prosecutors can give bail for these what we call essential infrastructure related offences. Only the court can give bail. That is in the one way. And this will then ensure that we send out a message of the seriousness of the essential infrastructure related crime. Then also, why do we want people to take serious consideration of whether or not to grant bail? Because often persons out on bail, the criminal proceedings are delayed for a very long time, and that results in the loss of evidence and the disappearance of witnesses. I'm sure all of you have read about that in the papers, and that is one thing that we think is forced to counteract through the bill. And then, of course, if accused persons are out on bail, police investigations might become more difficult. And then in clause 3, as I already indicated, that's where the new offence is. It criminalises the unlawful and intentional tampering with or damaging or destroying of essential infrastructure. And you'll see that there's a severe penalty. This is the maximum penalty for imprisonment not exceeding 30 years. You will also note that we have in the bill before you also a penalty of a fine. That is only for juristic persons like companies who are charged. You can't put them in jail. You will later see that there's a penalty and a fine for not exceeding, I think it's 100 million rand. And of course, the seriousness of the offense is emphasized by prescribing a half sentence. One may ask, but why was it necessary? We have the common law offense of malicious damage to property. Why new offense? Chairperson, first of all, we often this malicious damage to property is regarded as a minor offense. And sometimes what is happening there, people are trying to steal tables, but that's not completed that act of stealing, and all that you can prove is damage in any event. So by in the inclusion of this offense, it will cover that scenario as well. And of course, if it's damaged, sometimes it's damaged and it has the same effect as if it's stolen because the service cannot be provided. Then, like I said, the CPA it regulates the balance, the police and the prosecutors, and like I said, only a court will now be able to give bail to a person. But if you look at the second change in the CPA relating to bail, this is who bail for owners. There are two possibilities. The first is, and that is, I should say, it's the general rule. The general rule is that the accused is entitled to be released on bail, and the state must prove that the interests of justice do not permit his or her release. That is one possibility. The other possibility, which is the exception to the rule, is to say the accused must be detained in custody unless he or she produces evidence which satisfies the court that the interests of justice permit his or her release. Now, if you ask the exception to the exception to the rule applies only to offences that are listed in Schedule 5 to the CPA. So in order to know what we try to do here is to get to a situation where the owner is on the accused to prove to the court that his or her release is in the interest of justice. So there is a reverse owner. And then what we're doing is we're adding some essential infrastructure related offences. We will insert that in Schedule 5 so that you get that effect of the reverse owner. So we are going to, in the bill, there are six new offences to be inserted in Schedule 5 and in respect of which the reverse owner shall apply. The first is the offences under Prevention of Organised Crime Act. And these offences relate to racketeering, it relates to proceeds of unlawful activities, which then includes money laundering and criminal gang activities. Just by way of explanation, Chairperson, racketeering is not a terminology that everybody is familiar with, but basically it means that is when you receive property, and that property was derived from plans, ongoing and continuous participation in the involvement of at least offences which are listed in the Act. So you make a living out of crime, basically in short. Then also money laundering, that is the other offence that we want to include there. Money laundering is where you have, or you know, this property, and that property is coming from criminal activity, and then you enter into a transaction with somebody that you take that money and you will deal with that money in a way as to conceal the nature and the source and movement of the property. So you take the money, you put it in your bank, and nobody will know that the criminal that receives the money. And then, of course, unlawful activities is just conduct which constitutes crime or which contravenes any law. So that's then the scope of things. Now, the criminal gang activities, Chair, there is an exposition in the slides of what that means, just for interest sake as well. And then, what is important to know is part of the offences there, they don't stand on their own. Money laundering are always done in relation to another offence. So, for instance, when you sell the copper and you sell it to the second-hand dealer, and the second-hand dealer then deals with that, but in an organised fashion, then that's where COPA comes into play. The second offence that we're going to insert in Schedule 5, so that the reverse owners is applicable in respect of us, is offences under the International Trade Administration Act. So that is the Act regulating import and export, and you can see there on the slide what exactly that is about. And then also, you can just see why we say serious. Even the Parliament has decided for these offences, they can carry a fine not exceeding 500,000 or imprisonment not exceeding 10 years or both. So that in itself is a serious offence. But we also need do is we want to cover the whole illegal value chain in this process. We want to cover the cutters, we want to cover the second-hand dealers, and we've already, by way of incorporating the international trade offences, we've covered the agents responsible for exports and imports and exports. So you will see there we've covered a lot of offences under the second-hand goods actually, and what we feel is if you close your register for you apply for registration as a second-hand dealer, it's very easy to get away with stolen goods. And so all the other offences there, we think they are directly to related to what's going on in practice now, and because of the fact that they give false information, because of the fact, if you look at the other slide, they discovered or they acquired property and they're not sure that the seller is the legal owner thereof. And hence we have included all these offences of the second hand goods as in Schedule 5. Also to indicate the seriousness of these offences in terms of the second hand goods as all these offences carry a maximum penalty of 10 years. Now, Chairperson, if you look at the bill and you look at items 2 and 3, that is now the ICA and the Second Hand Goods Act, you will see it's very limited. It's not if a dealer deals with any scrap metal that these reverse owners of provisions come into play. It will only be if it involves essential infrastructure, because we have drastic measures here and we know we only want to deal with how the problem manifests itself in practice. But you will see with the item 1, we are to answer to the offences in terms of FATCA. We have not restricted to offences involving essential infrastructure. The reason for that, Chairperson, is you recall we said FATCA offences are always in relation to other offences. And what we're saying is, you know, the problem about the Rhino poaching as well, and Parliament has been asked, you know, there was a question that our minister must look at that as well. So not by, we thought that the FATCA offences, all of them in itself is so serious enough that all of them should have been long ago included in that with in the schedule without limiting it to offences involving essential infrastructure. But the fourth offence to be included in Schedule 5 is just theft, and that's only theft involving essential infrastructure under certain circumstances. First of all, if that caused an interference with a basic service rendered to the public, and Chairperson asked, you know, we've all been stuck, we didn't have electricity, so that is to cater for that. For damage caused to essential infrastructure, and then also if the offence was committed by a person in position of trust. And then, and the people that those are law enforcement officials, it's security officers, it's employees, contract workers, or if it was the offence was committed by a group of persons acting in a common purpose. And then one would say, but you individuals stealing a cable worth of R1,000, why this heavy burden on them in as far as bail is concerned? Unfortunately, the value of the property is not much, but the harmful consequences, it's severe, and that's why we deemed it necessary to cover the individual, as I explained to you, to cover the whole chain. And So this is not new to bring in theft under the Schedule 5. There's already a precedent for that. If you look today at Schedule 5 of the CPA, you will already see theft is in there. So theft in itself can be a serious offence, but it's limited, unfortunately, at this point in time to amount involving more than R500,000, or if it's more than R100,000 in a committed by a group or by a law enforcement officer. And hence the meeting to say is, let me look at including theft, but under different circumstances, as I explained, and also with, you know, if it's committed by a certain person in position of trust. The fifth offence is a contravention of Section 36 of the General Law Amendment Act. That is, Chairperson, is the inability of a person to give an account of the possession of which stolen suspected to be stolen. That's the one. And then also the other one is Section 37 of the same Act, which deals with the receipt of stolen property without reasonable cause. But all of that, once more, is confined to only if essential infrastructure is involved. It's not all sections 36 and 37, it's only involving infrastructure, essential infrastructure. So the reason why we include sections 36 and 37, because it's not known who has stolen the property, where the property was stolen, and who the owner is, if we want to cover that scenario as well. And then the last offence to be inserted is clause 3, the damage in the new offence there. And as I indicated, the bill also is going to change the law insofar as minimum sentences are concerned. Now, minimum sentences are dealt with in section 51 of the Criminal Law Amendment Act. And what is important there is to realize that there are different periods that may be imposed for different offenses, and depending on whether this person is a first offender, a second offender, or a subsequent offender. So there are in Schedule 2 of that Act, there's a Part 1, there's a Part 2, 3, and 4 presently. Now, just to tell you more about what is the sentences, the prescribed minimum sentences in the different parts, Part 1, imprisonment, pull out, we're not going to touch that. Then Part 2 is 15, 20, and 25 years imprisonment. Part 3 is 10 years, 15 and 20 years, and Part 4 is 5, 7, or 10 years. So what we want to do now through the bill is we want to insert a new Part 4 in Schedule 2. And that part will then make provision for a new prescribed minimum sentence ranging from 3 to 7 years. It's actually 3 years, 5 years, and 7 years depending on whether it's a first, second, or third offender. And I'd like to talk to you about the offences to be included in that part. But here, what is important to realize is that although we talk about minimum sentences, this section allows the court to depart from that prescribed minimum sentence, but only substantial and compelling circumstances exist which justify the imposition of a lesser sentence. And may I please just add that it was because of this discretion still that the Constitutional Court declared this as the Minimum Sentences Act as constitutional. So if you look at Clause 6 then, you will see that we're going to insert a number of offences in Part 2 of Schedule 2. And these offences are similar to the offences that we discussed that we're going to include in Schedule 5 to the CDA. We're going to include these offences in this part so that any offence mentioned in that schedule will then attract 15 years, 20 or 25 years imprisonment. So the first offence is the focal one. I've explained to you it's exactly the same as with the bill. It says that we're not going to include Section 9 here because Section 9 deals with criminal gang activities. But it cannot be included because the maximum sentence there ranges from 3 to 8 years. So we can't then impose a 15 or 20 or 25 years imprisonment. Then the second offence is the theft. It's basically the same as we discussed insofar as the Criminal Procedure Act is concerned. Then also we're going to include the offence related in Clause 3, that's the damaging one. And what we say is the reasoning behind that is that the high level substantial infrastructure related offences result in the disruption of basic services, negatively affecting the well-being of the public, and give rise to service-related discontent with infected communities and, very importantly, losses to the economy. And we want to create jobs. So once again, that is something that we thought could serve as motivation. And then the head sentences, the 15, 20, and 25 years, must signify the seriousness of the offenders and the intent to safeguard the interests of society by signaling to the courts that the imposition of harsher sentences must be considered. And then, of course, the other change in the minimum sentencing legislation is we want to ensure that minimum sentences ranging from 5 to 10 years imprisonment can be imposed on dealers in second-hand scrap metal and agents where essential infrastructure-related offences are involved, and hence we want to include in Schedule 2 the section the offences referred to in Section 54, one of the ISO Act, is similar to the bail one, and also these offences relating to the referred to in Section 32, which relates to or under Second Language Act, they are inserted in Part 4 by Clause 5. And then we've got Clause 8. You will see that is where we're going to insert the new part, 4, 5 in the schedule. And that's to provide for the offences referred to in sections 36 and 37, and for all other states that has not been included in the previous parts that we've discussed. And the effect of this insertion is that minimum sentences ranging from 3 to 7 years can then be opposed for the sections 36 and 37 and other forms of offence. So basically, if you look at the minimum sentencing regime that we're trying to change, is the minimum sentence for any of the included essential infrastructure-related offences is 3 years. So nobody can get less than that. That is in terms of that, unless, of course, the court uses its discretion in terms of Section 15. And then the Clause 9 is what we call a chairperson of consequential amendment. It's amending Schedule 1 to the power by inserting this newly created offence in Clause 3, so that certain provisions of POPA will then also be applicable to the offence created. Just to explain to you, for instance, if you get a person with high-tech equipment there at the substation of one or other municipality who's damaged, they can go to the court and ask for a preservation order, which actually just means you can't use that thing anymore, you may not dispose of it, and then later they can ask for a confiscation order. That is basically to cover instances like that. And then the last clause, dear person, is just to, it's clause 10, it's just to contain a short title and amendment, because we think that if we need to give the police and the prosecutors time to get familiar with this and to change their directives or their prescripts or policies before we put the act into operation. From my side, Chair, that's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I don't know whether our members we can ask questions, or we can allow also the presentation. Number two, if it's one presentation, be presented to us. And then we ask questions of the same. I think it's good. We can proceed to the aspect for you to speak. Sorry, I'm not question. I thought because the two are completely different, so we need to deal with one and then agree and move to the next one.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're quite right. We also like to ask you. Can you ask some questions and clarity if you remember?
Thank you, Chair President. I think one is we also welcome this particular proposal in the sense that the ignorance of, you know, offences towards infrastructure was threatening a serious challenge to the economy of the country. And I think to in a way bring back the confidence of the public representative to the people of South Africa to say we are always looking into the interests of the community. To me, the fact that we wanted to look at the much, you know, focus on the organized, you know, kind of and then those who have turned it to be a business. It's good, but my worry is, you know, this organized kind of business, they are exploring and, you know, using our people on the basis of the state of poor and then unemployment. You are going to find me, innocent as I am, being used without even being aware of the money those whom I'm going to provide going to generate out of the, you know, the infrastructure vandalization that I'm going to do. Maybe again to caution and make sure that even ordinary people, yes, you know, some of these things as you discuss them, Chairperson, you will sound xenophobic, but it's not the intention of my discussion in this matter. some people came to South Africa after they would have, you know, dehumanated by their countries and others. And to them, 1,000 means a lot for their lives. The fact that being in South Africa, even your state or socio-economic will then be improved, you will be guaranteed of, you know, minimal health, you know, basic requirements without payment. It then attracts a lot of people to come to South Africa. And then if we would then said, because they are innocent, they are just doing it, why it will become a way of, you know, big bosses that are, you know, sitting somewhere in Sandton, sitting somewhere here in, you know, alongside the beaches, occupying expensive, fancy properties, they will never be on the street. You'll never see them on the street, but they are the beneficiary of people like me who look, you know, as acted out of, you know, just, that's not just, I'm trying to say, maybe as we are looking, we must look, you know, even you know, the area that these food soldiers, they should, you know, refrain from allowing themselves to be used. But key is when we trek until we go to, you know, these big bosses in certain. Because they, I'm telling you, they are destroying our people. They're making the society to become a criminal society. While, you know, people who are on the sea, they're just gone, you know. That being pushed to say, if you can come back with this pen, I'll give you 1,000. The poor person seeing the 1,000 out of this pen, to him, this pen does not have anything. The fact that he will be given 1,000, he can even kill you just to obtain this pen. So I'm saying, yeah, maybe a bit of a balance in both the bosses and the foot soldiers should also be seen
It is true that if you look at the implementation of the bill, you look at three areas at least where there will be financial implications. The one is, as prosecutors and police officers will no longer be able to deal with bail, all these cases will go to court. But we don't foresee that there will be so many cases per court and that it will really lock jam the court rolls. But of course, that will have a financial implication, and also the issue of the minimum sentence that we also have, insofar as prisons are concerned. But we have, this bill has been consulted with SAS and the NPA in particular. So insofar as the training is concerned, that is why also we've got the commencement provision. So as you give the NPA and the SAS the opportunity to train people and maybe on a cascading down a basis as well. So they're fully aware of these provisions and that they will tell us when they're ready, but they are fully aware of the fact that this piece of legislation is very important. So they really will have to work fast and work hard so that very soon after the president, if he signs it, that we can bring the put the act into the operation. But from day one, the NPA and the SAS, both of them were involved in the drafting of that. And as we went through the process, they are involved and they're fully aware of the processes and how they will manage that. Of course, there are many cases that go to court for bail now as well because of the fact that there's limitations for prosecutors and the SAPs to give bail. So I don't know whether my colleague wants to add something.
You know,
we've
also a problem in our forest now. There will be no impact about this minimum salary.
Chairperson, yes, we've looked at that, and if you want to be our minister, where is the other as well? But somewhere you must draw the line, and that is the problem. And just to explain as well, it's not, you know, there are many serious offences, but many of these serious offences for which harsh penalties, long-term imprisonment sentences are imposed, those offences were only committed in respect of one or two other persons. What do we have here? We have one person for financial gain, whether, and we call them subsistence, they steal. And it affects the whole community. Like in one instance in Pretoria West, where that substation, the cable was stolen there for almost 3 days. That whole community, I think it was 3 or 4 suburbs, didn't have any power. It included schools, it included hospitals, it included old age homes. So if you look at that effect, it's where on what should bore the highest price?
Thank you very much. I concur with my honourable Jose. Thank you. Can we proceed?
Yeah. No, except that I guess we what is it, the committee decision on the bill?
On the bill. I think this cause is still going to the MA. Then if the MA can adopt it, then we can proceed.
It's already from the NDA chair. They've conducted public hearings on the 13th and 14th, which is 2 weeks ago. And being a section 75, and given the importance of the matters that the bill is in signature, my view is being a delegate from my province, I don't see any interest of the province being affected, Chair. Perhaps I must just propose that we compare with other amendments. Thanks.
We can take note of the proposal to adopt it, but we cannot report yet on it because the National Assembly hasn't adopted it yet. I do believe they are sitting either today or tomorrow to consider that. Once you refer to the National Assembly, then we can adopt the report yet.
Thank you, Chairperson. I go to a meeting and I look to the amendment. This amendment, why does it have a portion of refunding what has been stolen? Rather than 30 years. I'm looking at the years. Allow myself to be contradictory on this. Because I'm not going to say it's wrong. I appreciate because the background is giving one acknowledgement that most of currently I'm convincing most of these cable is done mostly by the foreigners.
so high, you have to forget it.
One is this and in the issue of the gift of Kopa gift. But I've got a feeling, because most of the things, conversations, our youth is used because of the money. I'm open with this. Because they've got no job, they have nothing. They are hired to do these things. Then the problem is about the syndicate. That's the problem. The law doesn't probe in to go straight to the syndicate. It's dealing with the phases that is put in front of them. I'm sure you understand what I'm trying to explain, even if I'm not affiliated. What other measures can put in place within the parameters or before even the sentencing that the handler must be exposed? Those are issues that our law can dig deeper in terms of time of phrasing out the amendment, because this, the current law doesn't assist us on what I'm explaining. Then the amendment to me, if it can give deeper to the purpose of rooting out the syndicates and the people are hired to do the jobs. I don't know although my colleagues are, for example, the man who's laughing at me is me, but I'm sure the learned people understand me. Because our country is built by these syndicates who are sophisticated, who are not South African, but using our own people. I want to hand like that.
No, madam, your point is taken. I'm sure you understand what you're saying. Yeah, the page is full. Thank you, thank you.
As far as this intercourse compensation is concerned, there are two possibilities. There is Section 300 in Criminal Procedure Act, where if your property has been damaged, then you can apply to the prosecutor, and that way the court will give them a compensation order. And you take that order and you go from there to civil court and register that if it was an order of the civil court. That's one way. And then there's another piece of legislation that I've forgotten the title of the act, in terms of which you can civilly claim the damages. I've been told by, I think it was the SAT3 representative just yesterday, that there was one example where a municipality used that act to reclaim damages. I think it was the city of Cape Town. So unfortunately I forgot what the name of the act is, but that is specifically, but not all people want to go to that room, but they are the damaging, the compensation part. And then as far as the youth is concerned, I can just say that is true. If in many occasions, I think if you look at the intelligence gathering, it's individuals and poor ones and young people that are youth. But what the NPA has said is they have, they call it, they prioritize organized activities. So they focus so much on that, and because of the fact that the Act will allow now the police to have this person longer in prison, in that only courts will leave that file, it will, about to them, it will enable the police to have to improve their investigation, because often they just can't with somebody in possession of something, and then the person was violent, sometimes, you know, you don't have, the police and the prosecutors, they don't have a mechanism to deal with bail application in the way the court can. So by providing for stricter measures about bail, it will also give the police opportunity to improve their investigation. And I can just say it's not written in law, but it's true that the NPA confirmed that on many occasions that they prioritize these syndicates because that is where the money goes. So they're really trying to do that. Insofar as the other aspect of that is concerned, Jefferson, that is why POCA, the offences under POCA, have been inserted in Schedule 5, which deals with the bail and the minimum sentences. And in that way, we're really trying to focus also on that. But of course, you can't rule out that individuals will still be the subject to the stricter provision.
Chair,
if
I may
just
add to that, thank you. respond to the Honourable Member's concern about the youth and children, I'd like her to rest assured that the Child Justice Act won't come into play because that's related to children who commit offences and the special procedures there to protect them. And the minimum sentences regime does not and cannot apply to persons under the age of 18, so they won't fall into that category where they can attract minimum sentences. The Child Justice Act, I would like to argue, takes care in terms of the special procedure which are there for the best interests of children, that the harshness of this particular bill won't really affect their children.
Thank you very much.
Rates of Interest Act of 1975. And this is a short act, and at the moment Section 1 of this act provides that if there's interest and the rate at which the interest is to be calculated is not governed by any law, by any agreement or trade custom, or in any other manner, such interest shall be calculated at the rate prescribed under Subsection 2 by the Minister of Justice after consultation with the Minister of Finance. What happened in practice was that this prescribed rate of interest really didn't keep abreast of realities and didn't keep abreast of the repo rate determined by the South African Reserve Bank. The National Treasury came to us and said, let's line these two, and they proposed they said the prescribed rate of interest should be similar and based on the on market principles, and National Treasury proposed that the interest rate in this act should be based on the repo rate plus 350 basis points of 3.5%, and that it should be adjusted by our minister every time the repo rate changes, and that's what Clause 3 of our bill does. I may move on to this clause also has general consensus. Clause 3 amends the Magistrates Court Act, not the Magistrates Court Act, not the Magistrates Court. It amends the Magistrates Act, not the Magistrates Court Act. And it amends Section 13. Now, Section 13 deals with when the magistrate vacates office. And Section 13(5) provides that the minister may, at the request of a magistrate, allow that magistrate to vacate any office, to vacate his or her office, for any reason which the minister deems sufficient. So, in terms of this provision, if a magistrate is allowed to vacate his or her office, the magistrate is deemed, in terms of the law, to have retired in accordance with Section 16(4) of the Public Service Act and is entitled to pension benefits, as if he or she had retired. And this entitlement or deeming provision kicks in place regardless of the age of the magistrate. So the magistrate might not have reached retirement age at 55. So one must also bear in mind before we get to the actual amendment is that, and this is, we're amending the Magistrate Act to deal with situations where magistrates have taken their office to become judges of the High Court. I've given other information by way of background, but what we're trying to cater for in this clause is when a magistrate is appointed as a judge, and this is happening more and more. In the past, magistrates weren't considered for appointment as judges, and now you're getting more and more instances, which is a good sign of magistrates being considered for judicial appointments as judges. But bearing in mind that the magistrate that's going to be appointed as a judge must vacate his or her office and is deemed to have retired and must get the full pension benefits, this has financial implications for the state. And it should also be borne in mind that when a person is appointed as judge, you get a salary for life. So these magistrates appointed as judges, they find themselves in a very fortunate situation, and the state has to make a contribution to the pension fund by law, because these people are retiring early, but they've got to be paid out as if they are at retirement age. So what this amendment does is, are intended to prevent these unintended and undue financial implications that may be imposed on the state in situations like that. But what this amendment does, Clause 4, it seeks to insert new subsections 5A and 5B in Section 13 of the Magistrates Act. And in essence, these new provisions provide that a magistrate who is allowed to vacate his or her office only when he's going to be appointed as a judge is entitled to the payment of his or her accumulated actuarial interest in the government employees' pension fund, as well as the payment of all accumulated leave. But that magistrate is given two options, namely to have the payments made into a designated reservation fund, retirement fund, until the magistrate attains the age of 55 years, which is retirement age, or to have the payments made directly to him or her. This sort of puts a stop to magistrates being paid out as if they had retired, but they have not reached the age of amendments to the Judicial Service Commission Act and the South African Judicial Education Institute Act. At present, these acts impose responsibilities, accounting and administrative responsibilities, on the Department of Justice and on the accounting officer of the department, namely the Director General. But these responsibilities should really be carried out by the newly established Office of the Chief Justice and the Secretary General of that office. So the amendments to in clauses 5, 16, 17 and 18, which have a bearing on the JSC Act and the Judicial Education Institute Act, merely transfer the responsibilities of the department to the Office of the Chief Justice and to the Secretary General from an administrative and accounting point of view. And that's where those responsibilities lie, within the judiciary, not within the executive. So that takes care of those four amendments together. If I may then move on to clauses 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 and 11. These are amendments to three Acts of Parliament, namely Promotion of Access to Information Act of 2000, Promotion of Administrative Justice Act of 2000, and the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act of 2000. All these three acts have very similar provisions relating to the designation of judicial officers to deal with proceedings arising out of these three acts. So the amendments in these five clauses are the same. They are also intended to enhance the independence of the Office of Chief Justice and form part of the Department's of initiative to transfer functions relating to the judiciary from the Department to the judiciary where they belong. And as I've indicated, the provisions in the amendments relate to the training and designation of magistrates who are required to deal with matters arising from the application of these three acts. These three acts, just to give you a bit of additional information, Chair, background information, they were put on the statute book in the year 2000. That is before regional magistrates' courts were given jurisdiction to deal with civil and family-related matters. At present, these three acts only allow district courts magistrates to deal with these matters arising out of the application. So the amendments, the first category of amendments to all these clauses is to extend the application of these acts not only to district courts but to extend them to regional courts. And this is done by amending the definition of court in the three acts to include regional courts, and then there are also consequential amendments. What is the motivation for extending the ambit of these acts to include regional courts? Since 2000, many district court magistrates have received training on these three acts, and they have subsequently been appointed as regional court magistrates. We hope that the workload of the High Court, which is also has jurisdiction to deal with matters in terms of these acts, will be reduced if regional courts get jurisdiction, and we feel that the extension of jurisdiction will enhance access to justice, and it will be less costly than litigation in the high courts. So that's just one of the amendments, category of amendments in these three clauses. These provisions in these three acts also require the Chief Justice, in consultation with the Judicial Service Commission and the Magistrate Commission, to develop the content of training courses for judicial officers on these three acts. In all three acts, the Chief Justice must, in consultation with the Judicial Service Commission, the Magistrates Commission and the Minister, implement the training courses. In terms of all three acts, the Minister must table a report in Parliament relating to the content and implementation of the training courses. And again, these acts were enacted before the establishment of South African Judicial Education Institute. What the amendments, second category of amendments, entails is that the training now must be transferred from the Chief Justice and brought, that this responsibility must be placed with the South African Judicial Education Institute. I'm not going to go through all the slides. tried to deal with these amendments. I think I've highlighted what they're about and why they are there. The third category of what these amendments are about is transferring, as I said, the responsibilities of the Director General, Justice and Constitutional Development relating to the compiling and keeping a list of training for purposes of the three acts to the Magistrate Commission, and transferring the responsibility of developing the contents of training courses to the Judicial Education Institute. I have dealt with that. I'm not going to deal with all the slides relating to these because I've covered all globally. The amendments for all three acts are the same, so I'm going to skip these slides and go to Clause 12. And Clauses 12 and 13 amend Section 7 and 14 of the Judges' Remuneration and Conditions of Employment Act, again, making the Secretary General of the Office of the Chief Justice responsible for the general administration of this Act in the place of the Director General Justice. And they also intended to give effect to the initiative of the Department in terms of which responsibilities in terms of this Act are transferred to the Office of the Chief Justice where they currently belong. I move on into Clause 14, and may I deal with Clauses 14 and 19 together. They deal with exactly the same issues. They amend Section 65 of the Criminal Law Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act. Let me call it the Sexual Offences Act. And they also, Clause 19 amends the Section 96 of the Child Justice Act. What do these two provisions deal with? They deal with the reporting by departments, the role-playing departments, to Parliament on the implementation of those two acts. And at present, the Act requires the Minister to collate all the reports of the different departments that have got to talk to the implementation of these two acts. And that's your Ministers for that's your SAS, it's Justice, it's Social Development, it's Health, and it's your NPA. Now, our Minister must get all these reports and submit them to Parliament. And this has given rise to challenges in practice. What the amendments propose is that the Ministers themselves, not our Minister on behalf of the other departments, the Ministers themselves submit reports on the implementation of these two acts to Parliament by the 30th of September each year. And why the 30th of September each year is because that's aligned with when departments submit the annual reports to Parliament in terms of the public PFMA Act. At present, there's also uncertainty when must these reports be submitted to Parliament. I think this amendment will take care of it. All ministers must submit their reports to Parliament by no later than 30 September, and then they must report to the committee or committees of Parliament sitting separately or jointly as determined by Parliament. So still, Parliament will still decide who deals with, who wants to deal with the reports. Is it going to be the Justice Portfolio Committee? Is it going to be SAP sitting separately? Or is it going to be all the role-playing departments sitting together? So I think this is going to be a mechanism that's going to provide legal certainty, and the reports are going to be prescribed in terms of regulation. That's also the regulations will determine the format of the report so that you're going to get uniformity. They'll all be submitted to a central place in Parliament, and Parliament will then decide which are the best committee or committees to deal with them, and you interrogate the reports that have been submitted. I've summarised what is set out in detail on these provisions. If I may then move on to, I have already dealt with Clause 19, that's the amendment to Section 96 of the Child Justice Act, and I think there are only a few provisions left in the bill which haven't been dealt with. The one is Clause 20, and that amends Section 98 of the Child Justice Act. And what is this amendment about? It is intended to make it clear that Section 87 of the Child Justice Act dealing with the expungement of criminal records of children apply retrospectively. Let me just, by way of background, say that a general rule is legislation regulates future events and conduct. and they are always interpreted as applying only to cases or facts that come into existence after they were passed. In other words, there's presumption against retrospectivity. And the rules of interpretation of statutes say if a statute or provision of a statute is to apply retrospectively, this intention must be reflected very expressly in the legislation, in the provision. Now, what is Section 87 of the Child Justice Act about? It's about allowing, it's in the best interest of children, because it allows children who have committed offences, and certain less serious offences, to have their criminal records expunged if certain criteria are met. The criteria are set out in the slide, I won't go into that. And the intention of this provision originally is to give persons who are children, when they commit offences of less serious nature, an opportunity to wipe the slate clean and rid themselves of the negative implications of having a criminal record. So the argument is, because Section 87 doesn't have a clear indication that it applies retrospectively, it can only apply for future events. And this means that Section 87 of the Child Justice Act can only be used for the expungement of criminal records of children whose convictions occurred after 1 April 2010, that is the date when the Child Justice Act came into operation. This in turn means that children who committed offences before that date do not qualify to have their records expunged in terms of the Child Justice Act. And this would surely not have been the intention of Parliament, and we therefore recommend that Section 87 be amended so that it can be applied retrospectively in the best interests of children. And everybody concerned, including your NGOs dealing with children's issues, welcome this particular amendment. The last two provisions, substantive provisions, clauses 21 and 22, deal with very technical amendments to the Prevention and Combating of Trafficking in Persons Act. Clause 21 amends Section 15, and this section deals with protective measures in respect of which foreign victims of deals with protective measures in respect of foreign victims of trafficking. Section 15(1) of this Act provides that the Director General of Home Affairs may issue a foreigner in respect of whom a report has been made to a police official as provided for in Section 19, and B, the National Commissioner of the South African Police Service has in writing confirmed to be a person who might be able to assist in the police investigation relating to an offence under Chapter 2, issue a visitor's visa to remain in the Republic for the recovery and reflection period not exceeding 3 months for purposes of accessing the programs referred to in that particular Act. But the Department of Home Affairs, when preparing the regulations, raised the question whether this provision is also applicable in the case where a foreign victim of trafficking is in possession of a valid visa's visitor. So the amendment therefore intends clarifying an uncertainty by limiting the application of Section 15(1) to cases where the foreign victim of trafficking is not in possession of a valid visitor's visa or where his or her visa is about to expire. And then Clause 22 deals with also a technical amendment to the anti-trafficking legislation to provide for a broadening of what the Minister of Home Affairs may make regulations about, and it's technical in nature. Chair, that brings me to the end of the presentation. I've tried to summarise some of the provisions and deal with them together where that is deemed relevant, but the detail is in the presentation if members would like to see that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you very much for the presentation. Honourable members, if anyone needs clarity or question, this is your time. This is your opportunity.
As I say, Chair, it's a very technical role. Yeah. If you like that.
Thank you.
streamlined, really streamlining in terms of, you know, what the amendments are proposed for. And I think they cover, though I think it's close for, I hear that Loris was explaining in terms of the large remuneration of magistrates. That was, I'm perhaps reading more in detail, it would be better, but what he was saying, because it still said to me that the magistrate would still have their monies as they move. You know, that didn't was there. It still say that either they take the money or not. So I think it still has some kind of financial implication. I'm not too sure. Maybe he might want to explain further that. So, because my view is that if they're still allowed and would apply into a new post, they will have to get the money. But what happened in the scenario where the magistrate gives up because they earn less, and so we haven't done that remuneration part of it, based on public service, part of public service. If a magistrate leaves and, say, becomes a politician or becomes a senior civil servant, what happens? Because if this clause, if you could explain in more detail in terms of what happens in other scenarios. I know that they're saying that they developed this as a result of what they are witnessing with magistrate having been allowed to go to apply for judicial posts as in judges. But then what happens if with the other ones? I'm trying to, the point is the financial implication part of this whole thing, and what is proposed in the clause really does cover this concern. Thank you.
Any member?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, this is restricted only to situations where magistrates become judges. And maybe I apologize if I wasn't that clear. Magistrates, while our magistrates, that they contribute to a pension fund and to government employees' pension fund, that they build up over the years an accumulated actuarial interest they've contributed to that fund. So what Clause 4 does says if they are appointed as judges, they can get their accumulated actuarial interest after which they've contributed. That's only up to that particular time as appointment of as judge. The present situation is, because the law reads as it does, they are deemed to have retired, because the minister allows a magistrate to vacate his or her post, that person is deemed to have been retired. And that being the position, and because we don't have this clause that we not propose, because they're deemed to have retired, the government or the state must paid twice and pay up, because magistrate is entitled to be paid out as if he had retired at the age of 55. But this amendment stops that. You get accumulated interest until the date you get appointed as a judge. And as I say, then they get the additional advantage of getting a salary for life from the date of appointment as judge. So I hope that clarifies it. So,
my name is just confirming that in terms of the effectiveness of reporting out of the department research, a degree of consistency and uniformity in report for special offenses. Talk about clause 15 and child justice clause 19. But here's the plan was already of getting reporting and
if you have a look at clause 14, maybe I should read it, the minister must, the various ministers, the role-playing ministers, must replace it on 30 September of every year, after the commencement of this Judicial Matters Amendment Act, each year submit reports as prescribed. And as prescribed, I think, is an important phrase, to Parliament by each department or institution contemplated in Section 63(2) on the implementation of this Act, and report thereon to a committee or committees of Parliament sitting jointly or separately as determined by Parliament. Mr. Chair, I would like to think that the, you know, the new words as prescribed will make a difference, because that means the reports are going to have to comply with regulations that are going to be made, and the regulations are going to set out what the reports must deal with. And I presume when those regulations are made, bearing in mind that there are different role-playing ministers, you've got the Minister of Such, you've got the Minister of Social Development, so your, and you've got the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services. So the regulations are going to have to set out what the templates, what the formats of the reports must look like, and what information must be included in the reports, so that you have certain uniformity in terms of the presentation of the reports, but then you're also in a position in terms of regulations to say what you want to hear about, what must SAPS focus on, what must Social Development focus on. And regulations, as honourable members will know, are easier to amend than primary legislation. So the benefit of this is, for 5 years, you might find that Department of Justice must focus on particular areas in their reports. Those areas might improve. But after 5 years, Parliament might suggest Justice rather focus on X rather than Y. And you can change the regulations to require the Department by law to come and report back on the things that Parliament wants to hear about. So you're going to get uniformity in terms of presentation, and you're going to get, Parliament is going to get information on what it decides should be in the reports going forward.
Thank you very much. Members, this is the same that I'm going to do. I'm not going to because we're still waiting for the House of Assembly to table to the House of Assembly. Thank you very much. I think Honourable George, can you have a vote of thanks to our officials? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. We would just like to thank the Department for the excellent presentations that they always come. Our apologies again for being a bit late today. But thank you very much for the excellent standard of assistance that's always rendered to this committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Yes, please. Members, I'll allow the short trip because there's another item number 5 where we think we seek a legal advice on this one. Can we just have it and then we come back to item number 4 that we release the official.
order that places a responsibility on the NTOP in terms of Section 25 to conduct public hearings. We have not done this in terms of the Principal Secure Amendment Bill, nor have we done this in the instead of these two bills. So we'd like to actually withdraw the adoption of this so that we can get that legal advice. So I'd like to hand over to the parliamentary legal advisor, who will then just explain.
Thank you, Chairperson. To the members, I am Advocate Gordon. I'm from Parliament's Legal Services. Just to reiterate what the Secretary as to the committee has said, that in terms of the Constitution, both houses of Parliament, the NA and NCOP, is under a constitutional obligation to facilitate public involvement in its legislative and other processes of the committee. Now, on the Defence Laws Repeal Amendment Bill, the NCOP has not done a bit of public participation. And particularly when we're dealing with the Section 75 Bill, the Constitutional Court has given a ruling many years ago in the decision of Justice for Life, but it indicated that each house separately is under a constitutional obligation to facilitate public involvement. So we can't have the excuse that the NA had had public hearings on the bill and so we don't have to do it at the NCOP, particularly on 75 bill. Both houses have to comply. With the 76 bill that goes to provinces, we know that the provincial legislatures do the public participation. And the court has said that when we're dealing with 76 bill that affects provinces, of course, it's important to have that public participation in the province because that's where the bill takes effect. So in 75, because the bill didn't circulate to the provinces as it does in 76, it places a stronger litmus test or yardstick to see if we've complied. So, Chairperson, just on that point, I'm of the legal opinion this bill is not ready to be adopted by this committee today because that process has not been complied with. Thank you.
Thank you. Is the order on the memo or you want to clarify on this? Chairperson, I hear what the legal unit is presenting to us. But I was of the view that NCOP is obliged in terms of Section 76, okay, to conduct public hearings as described by the Constitution itself. I'm not sure. You see, earlier we were discussing the implications of the court decision because to the little understanding that I'm having, the Constitutional Court and the judiciary are there to ratify and then, to look at the constitutionality of the Constitution, even the Constitution itself. You'll remember that when the Constitution was considered by the Constitutional Assembly, it must also be taken to the Constitutional Court before President Mandela, somewhere on the 10th of October, except indeed now this is the final product of South African proceedings. And in itself, it explains, in terms of Section 75, that laws that are to be passed in terms of that particular section, a huge responsibility will be, to the National Assembly, not the NCOP. We're talking about a similar kind of piece of legislation, which, while in terms of the Constitution, was supposed to be considered and finalized by, of course, we are giving a concurrent. So we once had a debate here to say we don't agree with what NAF said in terms of 75. And then we said, but then what's the use? Because it is not our thing.
Now, this is a Mary Gold setup. I'm not sure whether it should be the authority of the legislature that should engage the judiciary to say, let's not confuse ourselves. In a way, I feel there is a confusion somewhere. Of course, from time to time we amend laws, some of those laws that we amend based on the judgment of the judiciary when they pronounce the particular decision. But ordinarily, the role of the court is to interpret whether it's a confusion, in terms of what to be done. But this one, I'm not sure. I might be an illiterate, but I think I should not be found being abused because I'm illiterate. Today, taken from here tomorrow to another. I need to know whether what exactly informed this. It cannot just be because the court said that now Section 75 should also, possess the authority for both houses to conduct public hearings. I don't know. I'm not yet convinced yet. I might be convinced later, but for now, not yet, I must be honest with you.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Let me welcome the clarity with the condition that we subscribe to separation of powers. I just want to get clarity, Chair, from the legal advisor. What prompted an overlook from the side of the NCOB not to have a contract petition, especially? What prompted an overlook from the side of NCOB to embark on house participation as a legislative requirement, especially on Section 25 provisions? Given that even the two bills that are just appeared before us, if you check the one that is dealing with criminal matters amendment bill, if you check it was from the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Committee, there was no prior consultation on it. So I just want to get clarity of what prompted it, Chairperson.
Chairperson, I present to deal with the issue of the obligation on the ECOP to facilitate public involvement. The obligation is not set by the court. The obligation is set by the Constitution. The provision of the Constitution of 1772, the National Council of Provinces must facilitate public involvement in the legislative and other processes of the Council. So what happened many years ago? We had an incident, I think around about 2005, in the term of the second Parliament, that there was a particular, there were four bills, the one in particular, the Dental Technicians Amendment Bill, went through the National Assembly, 75 public hearings were complied with, got to the NCOP and public hearings were not done. We then had a challenge before the Constitutional Court, where Dr. Salai said that the bills are unconstitutional because Section 72 of the Constitution was not complied with by the NCOP. The court then ruled that particularly when we are dealing with the 75, that's where it comes from, that obligation in 72 must indeed be complied with. The court then said, when you're dealing with the 76, we must remember in terms of Section 118 of the Constitution, provincial legislatures also must facilitate public involvement. So the court is saying in the 76, what happens is that because the law circulates to provinces, because when we're dealing with the 76, it affects the vote. We vote by delegation in NCOP. When we vote on the 75, we don't vote by delegation. The vote is cast specifically individual along party lines. And that informs the public participation method. Because delegations vote on the 76, it has to go to the provinces. So the court said, let's look at it on the 76. If the NCOP has public hearings and provinces, they may be duplicated because the 76 is in fact affecting provinces. But that doesn't say we don't have to have public hearings at the NCOP. The court is saying we'll be happy on the 76 if provinces do it. They can see that NCOP is covered because it's the National Council taking into account provincial interests on a national level. so we'd be happy. Now, in the 75, we is that public participation happening. We don't have the provinces to fall back on, so we have to, as the NCOB on the 75, take into account the voice of the public on 75 bills. Even though I agree with members on a 75 bill, we can't amend the bill. It goes to the, we can only propose amendments that have to go back to the NA, but that doesn't mean that we don't have to comply with Section 72. That the Constitution is clear. It doesn't come from a court, it comes from the Constitution. The court merely gave guidance on how to give effect to Section 72. Then the second issue of why procedures were overlooked, Honourable Miller, I really can't answer you. That's a procedural. I think that's between NCFP procedural staff and committee section on how the bills are programmed. I, as I'm sitting here today, I'm not informed on what led to this oversight, but I'm just glad that we got to the point where we solved a bigger problem before it became a problem. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Members. That's thing roughly that we have to remove this one.
President, I just want to get like, even if it's not specifically to the advocate, but I just want to check moving forward what is going to happen. You know, and I think advocate Gordon would lose. You know the problem, and I'm talking from the point of view of developing the synergy between the NA and the SOP is at the crux of whether sufficiently we meet the deadlines. For instance, we are now left with 3 weeks. We rise on the 26th of November, and we look at the schedule of the program, the programming schedule of this. This matter was trapped. They tried to deal with the Manoel to the general, which remember, they are deadlines that are given to the executive in terms of when they supposed to have introduced all bills in parliament. And this deadline is not met. Meetings are being held with a leader of government business office, which is a deputy president, and programming committees of both houses, they raise this thing because the bills office of Ireland all the time present the bills before parliament, the report, and the state of the bills. But once they build the committees, there's no mechanism that changes the bill or that sets the deadlines for the bill to be completed so that it gives sufficient time to the SOP to deal with the matters. But also, you know, I don't want to offend Makalachi today, but the answer that says the Section 72, well, that clause says so, but you see, we still haven't resolved the matter of what in other legislative processes is allowed. One house is allowed to be recognized as parliament, the NA, even in the constitution, he is recognized as parliament. So when you say the NCOB must also conduct due interpretation of public hearings, and the clause says so, and they say that the court that this obliges us, I think it's a question that we need to engage on, you know, in giving a proper interpretation. I don't think that's what is intended. Maybe I'm talking to the unintended consequences, but if you had public hearings last weekend, you are not far from the Criminal Procedures Act last week, Amendment Act, 2 weeks ago, and now it's here today with us, and then next week public hearings within a short space of time. So I'm saying, check. I think it's a matter of debate, but going forward for now, we might have to then, just call it public hearings
is just a matter of compliance but not effective.
Let me comment on this one. Can we take this item back and then we discuss as a committee next time what can we do? Then we can expose you to that level of reading. If you can comment, so we can excuse it and the committee will discuss what is the right. Yes.
Not necessarily forceful advocate need comment. I think the point that has been raised by Honorable Nzimande carries water. Because if you check in terms of the presentation made by the advocate, especially on the issue of Section 76 provisions, she's more flexible to say if public participation or public hearing took place at the level of the province, it's being regarded as a platform where consultation was needed. While the question being posed now is, in this case where the NA portfolio committee embarked on a public participation, why is it overlooked as not being taken like the way it has been taken in terms of Section 76? Because the argument posed was, in this case, the court was able to make a determination that at least the province did embark on public participation in terms of Section 118, but it overlooked Section 72 in that regard. In this case, the NA embarked on public participation, which is also a consultation in itself, but there's an overlook again in terms of saying why duplicate. This is the question I thought the advocate would be able to tell about. But if it's not in opposition, we'll appreciate if a further engagement on this matter is needed.
Chairperson, indeed, I'm not in a position to, I think, answer that question satisfactorily. But I think on our side, when we do operationally with public participation, we too have this kind of question that we deal in the national bill, and effectively, public participation is conducted in National Assembly. But because of the constitutional provision, we don't have the benefit of saying that it absolves any COP from complying, particularly of the fact that the court has ruled on that. If I may go before the Constitutional Court case, many, many years before the Constitutional Court case, we indeed had that debate in our Office of Legal Services. And we had a split view on issues with some lawyers felt that, particularly what the men saying, that if the MA has conducted hearings on a 75, then why should the NCOP, considering it's a national bill, and NCOP would then be seen to be duplicating? And then we have the view that Section 2 of the Constitution says the Constitution is clean, law of conduct inconsistent with the Constitution is invalid. And so Section 2 overrides the operational requirements of the two houses. Because Section 72 enforces the public, the facilitation, and there is no mechanism that links the NCOP to public participation as it does in the provinces to the MA, because the two houses are completely separate. There's a link between NCOP and provinces because it's the council with provincial interests are taken into account. Now the council elevates that to the national level to be involved in national business, but there's no interrelated link in functioning on that level besides joint business on 75 bills between the NA and the NCOP. And that's why we're thinking that Section 2 of the Constitution enforces that compliance of Section 72. That if you don't comply, law or conduct inconsistent with the Constitution is invalid.
How far will the NA? NA is not the committee, it's not adopted.
Chairperson, I think the National Assembly Portfolio Committee has doctored the criminal matters, if I'm speaking of criminal matters, or to be closed. The House, no, I'm not.
Public
participating by the portfolio committee?
On the dissenting review, yes, there was. There wasn't, there was. I think there wasn't a lot of response submissions received. It was minimal, but there was a reply, and it was done. National Assembly. That's correct.
Thank you, honourable members. I think let's take the last item, which is the item number 4, consideration and adoption of the proclamation in respect of the entities involved in terrorism and the related activities identified by the United Nations Security Council, made in terms of Section 25 of the protection of the constitutional democracy against terrorism and related activities. Act 2004. This one has, it was here in front of this committee, and we decided to take it back. Now it's in front of us today. Can he adopt it, this proposition? I'm not in the commission. How many
months? Yes, I'm aware that what I was going to suggest might be a sub-attack to one of us who very strongly is saying it's other elements to be, you know, considered, but nonetheless we may not have it for the rest of our lives sitting in front of us. I move that it be adopted by the committee.
Thank you very much. Is there any second there?
These being proclamations, and the debate was last week, last time, that these being proclamations and in relation to entities, as you read there, and our participation in the UN. And if I may, Chair, even saying that even the issue politically, not this one, but the issue of the ICC having discussed it at NGC, and the decision for now, we're not out. And therefore the decision, we're not out. So the argument... The arguments that were put before politically on this matter, Chair, I think in my view are taken care of by what the AGC pronounced on our participation in this matter. So I really say, Chair, second the approval of the proclamation. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Thank you very much for working together, and I think the meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Excuse me, there is an announcement. Okay. Thank you.